right, welcome to a brand new episode of Guitar Talk. I'm your host, Jimmy Warren. You know, I get up every Wednesday and pretty much pinch myself because I can't believe this is what I do. I get to talk to the greatest guitar players from around the world, some of the most interesting people with the most interesting stories from all over, all styles of music. It is just a dream come true for a guy who absolutely loves the guitar like I do. And, you know, last week, Doug Pinnick from King's X was on. The week before that, Scott and Brian from Foghat were on. And tonight, we got one of my favorite guitar players in the blues rock world. I think he's one of the best. And part of what drew me to him, and I'm going to tell you who it is in just a second, but what drew me to him was his sound. I mean, his sound was just so massive. It's just so ballsy, so beefy, just... it's gritty. It just, for me, it draws me in. I just absolutely love his sound. And so we had an opportunity to sit down and, you know, hash out a conversation about what it takes to create such a massive tone, the gear that he uses and how he's doing it and what's going on in his world. And I'm talking about Eric Steckel. Now, I know you probably know who he is, and if you don't, oh, do yourself a favor. Go check this guy out, man, because he's badass. He really is badass. One of my favorite blues rock players of all time, most definitely in that. I mean, again, it goes back to the tone. The tone is just genuinely badass. So do yourself a favor. Sit down, put your feet up, get a nice cool beverage, and enjoy this conversation with the great guitarist Eric Steckel, right here on Guitar Talk. I got to tell you, Eric, man, your tone is the fucking die for, man.
Oh man,
well, it
thank
is.
You. Wow, thank you. Yeah, you know what? Let me do one thing really quick that it might help with this. I'm gonna put the original sound on. It's called, and it makes usually it doesn't dip then with the limiter thing, you know. So I think we're good now, right? Everything looked sound okay?
Yeah, man. Perfect. Great. I appreciate us being able to do this. I've wanted to meet you and talk to you for a very long time because, as I said, when I scour the guitar world for tone, all roads lead back to Eric Steckel.
Oh wow, that's high praise, man. That's very high praise. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But it's got to be. I mean, I you know, everybody says tone's in your hands, and I know that it is to some degree. But let's admit it: those Mesa Barbara amps, they're to die for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my personal take on that whole debate, you know, which is very subjective, of course, right? And it will go on long after we're all dead, you know.
Yeah.
But my personal take on that is that it's just everything working together. So yeah. Because, you know, like when people say tones in the hands, that's a very like broad sort of thing. Because like an example I always use when I do clinics and stuff about that is, you know, I'm friends with so many great guitar players because of where I live here in LA. So many of them are out here, and I've been in situations where I've handed them my guitar or vice versa without touching any of the settings. And what I notice is, like, we're all good at what we do. We're all professional, but there's differences. Like, I know one time Orianthi picked up this exact guitar from me, right? And she looked at me and she was like, oh, cool. But she's like, yeah, this neck is too big for me. It's not what I'm into. And I've had people plug into the my Mesa Barbas the way I set them with everything on 10. And my good friend JP Cervoni, the guitar player for Buddy Miles for many years, he always says, Eric, if I'm going to play through your rig, I want you to put that gain at half and turn down all the bass, turn up the treble. So yeah. It's almost like it's, I know what people mean about the tones in the hands, but it's way more nuanced than that. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. 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 So I gotta know, you know, how did you come, you know, to be affiliated and to be using, you know, the Mesa Barbara amps? You know, because I mean, it's not an amp that everybody uses. I mean, no. I rarely see anybody with one, but every time I hear one, I'm always blown away by it. So I'm curious how you got connected there.
Yeah, so all credit where it's due. It's actually my buddy Doug Rappaport. He plays he plays a lot of different amps because people hire him to do reviews and things. But I remember probably I don't know like late 2017, early 2018. Meza Barba had sent them. I sent him one of their just normal models, not a signature model. And he did a couple of YouTube demos with it. And I remember the first thing, even before the tone, the first thing that drew me in was I've never seen red Transformers in my life, like on an app, right? So I was first drawn in by just the visual aspect before I even heard the tone. And then because I know his playing very well, him and I have been friends for years. So I know when a guitar player is inspired by the tone and when they're not. You know what I'm saying? And I was watching him play through this Meza Barba, and he had, a big smile on his face and the sustain. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, this is something to, make a mental note of this company. This is interesting. And at the time, I was playing diesel amps from Germany, which, by the way, those are incredible as well. It's
Great
yeah. Well, I mean, at a certain point, we're splitting hairs. You know what I mean? It's like all. It's like Ferrari, McLaren. It's all up there. But basically, yeah, so I saw Doug playing them, and then I had reached out. It's actually a little bit of a funny story because me and Pierangelo, the designer, are like family now. I've had dinners with his parents. I mean, we're like really close. But when I first messaged him on Facebook, we still joke. We bust his balls about this because he didn't know who I was. And he responded and he said, very, very corporate, "Hi, Eric. Thanks for your email. At this time, we're gonna pass. We already have a few artists that we have endorsements with. So, and we see that you're playing Diesel, so that's a competitor. So at this time, we're gonna pass. And let's catch up in a few years." So here's then what happened. So JP Cervoni, who is actually, it's very complicated. He's my bass player now, but he's actually a famous guitarist for Buddy Miles, right? And he is Italian, and he is 50% partner of Meza Barba, but he lives right down the street in Van Nuys. So the
Fabulous.
story goes that Pierangelo calls JP and says, "Hey, I got this message from this guy. I never heard of him. Maybe you know him, Eric Steckel." And JP, I've lived in LA 10 years. He knows me. He goes, "Wow, Eric reached out to you." And he says, "What did you do for him?" And Pierangelo says, "Oh, I turned him down." And JP goes, "Get him back on the phone, man. What are you doing?" So then the next day they took me out for a nice dinner at Morton's, like almost an apology, like, "Sorry, we didn't know." And ever since then we've been super close, and these guys have been really like family actually. So it's pretty cool.
So when it comes to that sound, because I haven't dove into your rig. I mean, I'll be honest, I've got, I don't know, I think I've got close to 80 guitars myself. I
Definitely
don't
more
know
than
how
me.
many amps I got in that. But I covet your Nag, and I covet your, yeah, I do, man. I
This
do.
is
I
fraud.
wanted one so bad in that. But I'm curious when it comes to your tone, though. We talk about the amp, but do you add anything? I mean, are you using any kind of compression? You using delay? You using
Yes, so I'm proud to say that the only effects that I use, and this goes back for many years, actually, this hasn't changed. Even when I was playing Diesel, Bogner, whatever, it's always been kind of the same. I have either no pedals at all on the floor in front of me, or maybe a wah, but sometimes not even. Like the last few nights I was playing, I just didn't feel like, tripping over. I just didn't feel like using it, right? Because I only use it for a song or two, so it's not integral. So let's say forget about the wah for now. But the only effects that I use are time based. So just delay in the loop, and then I use an ISP decimator. And the thing is, when people kind of focus on that a little too much, like they go, "Oh, Eric's using a decimator." It's like, yeah, but it's only because I run everything at 10. So as we all know, high gain, there's no such thing as high gain without noise, right? They go together. So when I'm using the Meza Barba, and my model of Meza Barba, we can get into this later too, but my signature one, the blue one, that has like twice as much gain as the standard models, which
How'd
are
you do
already
it?
high gain,
That's
right?
crazy,
So
man.
So that's why I use the noise gate because, and I've had people try to insinuate like, oh, it shouldn't be noisy. And it's like, yeah, if the gain's on 4 or 5, it isn't. But the way I run it, maxed out, there's gonna be that hiss. So I run the decimator, not really high because I do a lot of dynamic playing with the volume knob. So I have to make sure that the gate is not too tight. Because we do this part in the show, we do this sort of famous song now called Empty Promises, and the dynamics, the drummer's using mallets, and it's really, really sensitive and soft. And I don't switch channels. I'm on the lead channel for 90 minutes, right? So I have to make sure that, so every night at sound check, even if my tech sets up my rig, I still come out and dial in the ISP myself because only the player can feel the way the gate is reacting. You see what I mean? So that's it, man. And then my two delays that are my go-to. This is my main one, the DD200. I love this one. I mean, I know that there's the DD500, which is even more, expensive, whatever. But first of all, even this size footprint is kind of still too big for me. And the 500 is like double the size, right? So for me, it's just this is about as big as I would ever go, with a delay unit. I like the I also use the where is it? I love these little guys too, man. These little
Oh,
reissue
yeah,
Echo
definitely.
Clips. Yeah, I mean they're cheap, man. It's like 100 and some bucks, and they sound great, and they're like indestructible, So basically, when I go on tour, it's either the DD200 or the Echoplex, and then always the decimator. And that's literally it, man. That's it. No boost, no compressor, nothing.
I learned a long time ago, and this might even be your train of thought, but I learned a long time ago. I've always hated reverb, right? I've never been a fan of reverb simply because I always feel like it just mushes up your sound, right? Even though at low levels it can be really cool, and and that, but it. And I remember I was having a conversation one time with Steve Lukather, and he was talking about stacking his delays in order to get that body, that fullness, that warmth. And so I kind of figured, because when I've seen you and I've seen videos of you, and I don't see nothing really on the floor, I'm thinking, okay, this guy's probably got a delay or two, in the back. And that's why you have it, I'm guessing, is for that body.
And I actually was just I just did a rig rundown video a couple days ago, and I was talking about this to those guys. I was saying that, the trick is like because the way I do things, I am literally the phrase set it and forget it. That's me. We do a 90-minute or sometimes 2-hour show, and I don't touch anything. And I mean that literally. I mean, I am in front with the people. I never turn my back to the crowd. I never fiddle around because, for me, yes, I'm a musician first, absolutely. And I'm a gear nerd like all of us. And I'm a geek like all of us. But I'm also an entertainer. And I grew up the way I kind of was raised and grew up, like, I really value the whole like being an entertainer thing. And I think a lot of guitar players, maybe their downfall is they're too almost introspective within themselves. They're maybe fiddling around during the show, or maybe they're visibly unhappy with their tone, so they're not really having like a great night because they're kind of fighting it. And I just vowed years ago, after seeing so many players go through this, I just vowed to myself, like, I don't want to be like that. I want to be right up front with the crowd, locking eyes with them, and I don't want to be distracted with my gear. So I've gotten to a place now, and it took many years, trust me. This was a lot of trial and error and learning and growing but I'm at a point now where when I go on tour and play, I just set the stuff and I just go out and I do the show, man. I don't really look back, I don't fiddle with knobs. And to get to the point you were bringing up about delay, I always make sure that my delay is set to a volume that does not interfere with the drummer, the tempo of the songs, the rhythm. Because if the delay is a little too loud in your mix, and you're using one delay time for a 90-minute show, you're gonna run into these problems where the drummer's grooving, and then you maybe you do a stop in the song and you hear the delay going bop 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 bop, but it's in the wrong tempo,
right?
So I was telling these guys, I said the trick, you have to make sure that the delay is, you have to treat it like it's reverb. Treat it like it's just this thing behind your signal that's giving it a little bit of body, but you never want it to get in the way of the drummer. You know, that's something that I think I really stress this with people when I do clinics and things, is don't oversaturate that delay, man, because you're going to run into, you know, timing issues.
Right. I'm a big fan of the Wampler tape echo, right? The Fox tape echo. I have two of them on one of my boards, and I live up to the fact that it is a tape echo because they are covered in electrical tape, so I won't turn the knobs like you were saying. You know,
literally tape echo.
I've had people say, well, you're taking tape a little bit too far here.
Yeah, very literal.
Yeah, but just small amounts, you know, just enough to give that body. So you're, like you say, you're not hearing that. Because when I listen, once again, when I listen to your sound in that, it's just full. It's warm, it's deep, it's full. And I can tell, you've come across from what I've seen and heard, You don't come across as a guy that, okay, I've got these settings for this song and these settings for this song. You're a guy that just goes in and you seem to be high energy every time I see you play.
Well, thank you. That's it's good to hear that, because that's certainly what I'm trying. That's certainly, you know, my objective, my goal. And I think, you know, that it's funny because that whole high energy thing, it's been definitely a gift and a little bit of a curse too, because, you know, it's hard to find. I mean, luckily I have, because I've been doing it a long time, but it's hard to find musicians who are exactly on that same page with you. You know, there are musicians who, you know, the idea of every night, like on a 90-day tour, every night coming out with the same rage and brutality and the same mantra of I'm going to kick your ass, man. Like that is something that, you know, that's physically difficult for one on a long tour. Cause you know, you're not sleeping as much as you would as when you're home, you're not eating the way you would when you're home. So your body's already running on about 70% power just because you're on tour. So to come out on a 90-day tour like we did in the spring and give that 110% every night, you'd be surprised. There's a lot of guys who talk like, yeah, man, I'm in for that. And then when you get them on the road, they start to kind of, they don't really mean it, you know? So I'm lucky. I'm at the point now where I've got quite a Rolodex of great players that I'm lucky to choose from, great drummers with the high energy. But what you noticed and picked up on is, I appreciate that, because that is my goal. My goal is if somebody buys a ticket to come see me, I want them to feel like after the show, like, man, I just got my ass kicked, man. Like, wow, what was that? You know, I want it to be just like a brutal assault of just chops and musicianship and tone. And, you know, and almost my goal is almost to make people go like, man, I've had my fill of guitar for a month. You know what I mean? Like, man, that was, you know, like, so that's my goal, man, for sure.
Like, that's even possible.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it would never be. I love what I do, man. I would if I went a month without playing, I'd probably, I don't know, man, slip into a coma or something, you know. But the energy, man, it is part of the sound, and it does dovetail with the gear, because part of performing a high energy show is not a lot of dead air and not a lot of, you know. I remember as a kid when my parents would take me to see bands. Even as a little kid, this bugged me. When a band was you know, great songs, great playing, but then the guy takes 5 minutes to like tune up, tell a story on the mic, nobody's really listening. They're walking to the beer tent, like, so that style of performing, I remember, like, at 10 or 11 years old, I would see that and I would go, I never want to be like that. I don't ever want the audience to be like, you know, checking their phone, kind of like, okay, when's the next song coming? I want it to be bam, 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 you know? Right. And if I'm fiddling with my tone, can't do that.
Right. The other thing, though, you know, since we're talking about that energy level and what that's like on tour and stuff, I mean, you really, I mean, I've been on tour, you know, I did it for a long time myself, and I know that it's so taxing on a person physically. So I'm going to take a guess that you're probably somebody that is really paying close attention to what you eat, what you drink, you know, physical exercise, getting the right sleep, all that kind of stuff, because you have to be in shape in order to be able to do what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's funny you said that, man, because like every tour that I do, this is what I love about this business that we're all in, because you never stop learning.
Yeah.
Like you never, you know, there's always something out there you didn't know. So every tour, I learn new tricks, new little ways of dealing with problems. You know, I find new solutions to when it comes to like physical health or stamina or whatever. And I found ways to try to preserve my voice a little bit. So it's funny because touring is such it's an art, you know, it's a delicate ecosystem, you know, touring. It's you have to be a really good decision maker, especially like in the moment. And I think, you know, the stereotypes that everyone knows about touring, you know, are accurate, of course. You know, lack of sleep, you know, not eating the best food, late nights, all that. Yes, that's true. But there are a lot of nuances people don't realize. Like when I tell people this, a lot of people who are not musicians, they go like, oh, I never thought about that. So here's what I mean. People always ask me about my voice. Like, how do you do like a 90-day tour and save your voice? And what people don't realize is the singing is not the problem, because I always have great monitors. We have, you know, we travel with our own guy, so he knows how to get the monitors dialed in. So on stage, I'm not taxing myself vocally. I'm usually very comfortable. Here's where the problem comes. You finish the show, you go to the table to do the meet and greet, and the venue puts on some house music.
You got to talk over it.
Right. So now you're screaming to people without a microphone, without monitors, and that's where you lose your voice. So again, like, and this is something that I didn't know. This really only occurred to me maybe like last year, and I've been touring for 23 years, because it's this thing where you keep touring, you keep learning, and you keep troubleshooting. So yeah, I mean, I'm certainly, you know, I certainly haven't mastered the art of touring, but I'm getting there. I'm each tour, I'm really filing away more tricks and tips and, solutions, you know?
Yeah. Good. Well, when you're young and when you're first starting out, it's like, you're just grateful to be there, you know? And then as you start to age and mature and stuff like that, you start to go, okay, I better take better care of myself. Because I recall, you know, I started out in the late 80s playing with all the blues guys in Chicago, Otis Rush and Buddy Guy and Junior Wells and all them cats. And it was just Lucky Peterson, Sugar Blue.
One of my favorites, Lucky.
Party. It was nothing but a party, you know? And it's like, you didn't sleep, you drank a lot, there was drugs, it was all this crazy shit. And then you wake up and you're like, in your early 40s, and you're like, oh my God, what am I doing? I can't keep up like this. You know, it's like, that's why when you see bands like, you know, the big rock bands like Def Leppard and, you know, guys like that, and you understand the crap they did in the early days, how they're even still standing.
It is amazing, actually. It is amazing. Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky that, you know, my personality, I'm lucky that I happen to be living and being here on this earth at a time where the whole like 80s mentality of touring is now like over. It's gone.
And
some people might say, oh, you're glad about that? And no, I'm not glad about the financial part of it being different, but I am glad that, because I've never been the kind of guy that wants to like push my body to extremes. Like, you know, like you were saying, in the 80s, a lot of guys would just say, let's keep the party going. Let's keep it going. And then worry about the side effects later. And that's not my personality. So I'm lucky that I'm out there doing it at a time when guys are now saying, hey, we got to find a gym on the road. We got to find good food. We got to take care of ourselves, stay at good hotels, you know. So I'm lucky that, you know, my personality matches with the era that we're in right now of touring, because many guys, you know, all the young guys that I know who are successful, they're you know, they're looking out for themselves, you know.
Right. That makes sense. Now, I understand that you're originally from Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania.
Yes, sir. Yes,
I bring that up because I have really good friends in the Lehigh Valley. As a matter of fact, I was just out there not that long ago. I know that that area is an amazing music area. There's a lot of venues, a lot of bands, a lot going on. So I mean, without asking a completely ridiculous question that everybody asks, but knowing your style right now, what were the things that you were paying attention to back in those days that have helped make you, you know, the player that you are right now?
Yeah, you know, again, you know, really, really credit where it's due. I didn't realize until I moved away from the Lehigh Valley that I happened to be born in this very interesting little oasis of talent that is so unusual, because like, it's different. If I was born in Los Angeles or New York City or Nashville, it's like, wow, it's a given. Of course there's talent, you know, but like Lehigh Valley, if you don't know about it, you don't know about it. It's it's a very niche thing. And, you know, as a kid growing up, you know, you're just like, hey, this is where I was born. This is where my parents happened to, conceive me. Right. So it's I didn't really think about it in terms of like, oh, this is something. I thought that, like, as a little kid, I thought that, oh, every town in America has a little mini music scene. And there's some truth to that, but nowhere near the way it was in the Lehigh Valley. Yeah. And I think later, as I got older and understood it more, from what I could piece together, it was because New York City was like 45 minutes away, and musicians that had families and children said, well, I don't want to live in the city. So I want to find some place in either Jersey or PA or Delaware where it's not a really bad commute, but I'm not anywhere near the hustle and bustle of, you know, of New York City. So, you know, all these players, like, you know, these guys that were around, this guy named Todd Wolf, who was Sheryl Crow's guitarist. He would have me up on stage. Anytime me and my parents showed up to see one of his gigs, he'd say, hey, is your guitar in the trunk? Let's go, let's jam. And then there were a bunch of other guys. There was a guy named Mike Dugan. There was a guy named Craig Thatcher. And all these players were very like, they all saw me as like someone that it was, I was very, I mean, there was like no ego actually, which I don't know, you know, if I don't know if that would ever happen like that again, where these local players would just have me come up on their stage and mentor me and take me under their wing. I don't know if that would happen. You know, if I rolled that dice, I don't know if that would happen more than once, because that was a very special thing where these guys had no ego about it. It was like, hey, here's a young kid from a good family and he loves the guitar and let's just help him out. Yeah. So, you know, learning how to lead a band and call out tunes and say, all right, give me a 6/8 in C, come in on the 4. Yeah. I wouldn't have known how to talk like that if it wasn't for these professionals saying, come on up, kid, right? So I'm very gracious to those guys. And it's a little bit sad that, you know, because I left the area not by my own choice, because my dad's job transferred him to Florida. So I left the Lehigh Valley when I was about, I don't know, 14 or 15. And, you know, it was interesting. People were kind of not supportive when we left, you know. It was like they thought it was something like we wanted to, you know, leave that scene behind, and that's not true. It's not true. It's because my dad's job transferred him, you know. And then, you know, 10 years ago I came out here to California with just, I remember it, man. I had a 1999 Honda. I had, I think I had my 65 Strat still at that point, and I had a couple grand, and I just drove out here expecting to just do a little vacation. 10 years later, still here, never left.
That's the way it works.
That's the way it
Crazy,
was.
man.
You know, the story that you just told, though, about how the people in the area would invest in you in the way that they did, it's funny. I just had this identical conversation with Scott Holt. I don't know if you know Scott.
Oh, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. Because Scott used to play with Buddy Guy
Right.
and back in the day when I was playing with blues guys up there. And I can recall that. We had a conversation about this. I can recall there was a guy in Chicago. His name was Buddy Scott. He had a band called Buddy Scott and the Rib Tits.
Okay,
Right?
nice,
All the
nice.
South Side joints. I mean, we're doing the Tyrone Davis, ZZ Hill, Little Milton type stuff, right?
Wow.
And he would do that with players like myself and probably you if you would have been there. You
Right.
know, people that were really into it and were driven in that, and they would invite you and they would coddle you and they would teach you
Right.
and that seems to me today to be gone.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I'm sure we could get into a long debate on why that is, but you're right. I think that if I was born in, let's say, the year, I don't know, 2010, and I was trying to, come up through the scene, through the ranks, and I don't think many people, I mean, there might be a few, but I don't think I would have gotten the open-armed sort of invitation like I did, in the early 90s. I think because the world was different, man. There was no social media yet. It was just a different, really different planet in the early 90s. And I think that if I had been born any later, I would have been more on my own. I think I would have really struggled to find mentors. And you know what? And I, from my perspective, now that I'm an older sort of veteran player, and young people come to me, I have to always remind myself of this and say, hey, the world's been good to you, Eric. Don't be an asshole. Don't forget what people did for you. And it can be tough because sometimes, sorry, I had a hair. Because sometimes you're in situations where you just can't have anybody come up on stage because you're playing maybe it's a festival set, you're playing a 55-minute set, there's no time, there's no sound check, whatever. And I always feel bad if I hurt someone's feelings, if someone has to sit in and I say, man, I'm sorry, buddy, it's just tonight's not gonna work, but I still do my very best to make sure that the young talent gets the same vibe from me that I got, many years ago. And because you're right, it's not quite the same anymore. I think people are a little more closed off than in the old days,
So what are some things, Eric, that you did when you were developing yourself as a player, when you were, in the formative days, that you can look back at now and say, well, it's because of those things that I can play the way that I can right now?
Wow. Well, I remember that there was a point, I think I was maybe 16 or 17, and this was after all the John Mayall stuff that I did. So this was, I had already, toured at this point and been pretty active. But it was like, yeah, I was in my teens, and I remember a friend of mine at school sent me, or maybe he gave me, a CD from an English prog band called Porcupine Tree. And I remember that as being a seminal moment of where I just went, like it's just because up until that point, and somebody might say, oh, you're being a little hard on yourself, Eric, but I see myself before that point as a bit of a clone, because when I watch those old clips of me with John Mayall, I mean, of course I get a kick out of it. It's amazing, the little kid with the guitar. I mean, that's all great. And I'm very gracious for that time and really gracious for what John, did for me. But when I critique myself, when I watch that critically and see what I'm doing, I'm like, okay, it's five Clapton licks, 10 Stevie Ray licks, and maybe a Hendrix lick. And that was the extent of it. And yeah, for an 11-year-old kid, yeah, that's impressive, of course. But I didn't really listen to anything other than just the blues. And then, like I said, my friend gave me this record. And I know exactly, for your listeners, if they want, it's the In Absentia record. It's the white cover with the blue face with the hand or something, and from this band called Porcupine Tree, which is totally not blues at all. And I just remember being like, I put this record on, and the writing, the production, and I was like, oh man, there's a bigger world out there than just what I've been listening to. You see? Yeah. And so that was the moment when I grabbed my guitar and I was like, man, there's so much more to music than just the three or four blues guys that I was, obsessed with. And not taking anything away from that, but for a while there, I was really just tunnel vision. Like, if it's not blues guitar, I wasn't listening to it. And my friend giving me that record, it just really opened up. So that's when my playing started to develop a little bit of more color. And I became less and less and less of a clone and a copycat. And then there was one more level to that, which is more recent, like very recent. So in 2017, I was at a point in my career where I had some, I had some downfalls, some low moments. I was not really feeling all that great about my career. Financially, I was struggling. And I remember I got about, $5,000 or $6,000 together. I was able to scrape it together. And I went into the studio and I went in there with a Tom Anderson guitar and a Diesel Herbert amp, right? And I said to the engineer, I said, what's your daily rate at this place? He said, for you, I'll do $500 a day. And it was, a world-class studio with the SSL and everything. So I went in there with this high gain amp, right? And with a Tom Anderson 24 fret guitar, so very modern, right? And I turned the gain on 10, bass on 10. And I recorded a blues album with this sound. And the album is out. It's called Polyphonic Prayer. It's my 2018 album. Right. And that moment was the moment that I said, oh, man, I have something original here. Nobody has this kind of tone in this genre. Yeah. So that was the start of this blues metal thing, as I sort of facetiously call it. And from that point until now, it's like, that was the moment when I really found myself and found my sound, and I was finally doing something that other people weren't doing. Now, I've gotten in trouble for saying this because the critics will say, oh, come on, Eric, you're not the first guy to play blues with high gain. Gary Moore, Zakk Wylde, and they're right. They're right. Mm-hmm. But what I tell people is I say, yes, but Gary Moore is sadly no longer with us. Zakk Wylde doesn't really play that way anymore. So I see myself as the torchbearer of this stuff. And I take it as like a responsibility almost, like to take that high gain blues sound into the next generation.
I love the sound. We started out with that, and it's funny because the industry, people in the industry, want to put you in a box and say, well, this is what you are, and people, I can tell you that people that I know, especially when I started telling some of the people that I know that you were going to come on the show, they were like, well, he's not blues at all. It's just too hard, and stuff. And it's like, well, just because the tone is the way the tone is, doesn't mean that what's being played underneath, isn't blues or it isn't heavy. And who are you to say? I mean, who are we to say? Good musicianship is just good musicianship.
Absolutely.
And creative talent is just creative talent. And, and I think that's what we all strive for, right? Is to be individualistic.
I'm really glad you brought this up because, something, and I've wanted, it's funny, I love that you've given me a platform to address this because I've always wanted to say this, actually, so thank you. Yeah. But my rebuttal to those, to folks who would say, talk about whether it's blues, whether it's not, or it's too heavy, whatever. The thing is, what people have to remember is, when Muddy Waters, went electric, that was controversial. So it's like the problem that I have with blues purists is, if you're a real blues purist and you say, man, the original guys is all that I want to listen to, and everybody after that, okay, I respect that. But if someone says, no, they say, oh, no, the blues from 1964 to 19, like, if you're going to be specific, then you're just a moron, because you're saying that only these 20 years are real and everything before and after it isn't. Like, that's ridiculous, right? So what I would say in relation to me, with all this is, like, okay, the blues is the most authentic music genre in the world. It is. It's the most real. So what's more real than a guy being himself? You see what I'm saying? So, like, this is the thing. If I went out into the world, I'm a white kid from the suburbs, right? If I went out into the world and tried to convince people that I'm a real deal Chicago, gut bucket blues artist, people would say, dude, look in the mirror. What are you talking about? So my thing is, like, guys, I'm being authentic to who I actually am, which is the whole point of the blues. And if Muddy was alive, and by the way, I have played with Hubert Sumlin. I've played with Bob Stroger, Bob Margolis. I have been on stage with some of the real deal guys. And here's the thing, they respect me because they know that he's not copying us. He's not trying to, he's not pretending that he's black and from Chicago. Like, they go, he's being who he actually is, which is what the blues is all about. So yeah, that would be my rebuttal to the purists who knock me. I'd say, okay, you're right. I'm playing with a very modern tone, and I'm playing with a very aggressive right hand. But that's who I
That's
am.
you.
So I'm not lying to you. I'm being honest,
That's funny because I know the guys you just mentioned, and I did some shows with Bob Margolin years ago because he was on one of my albums, and I remember the conversation on the phone. Jimmy, just as long as you know, I can't play that stuff. If we could just keep it, 1-4-5 and let me do my thing, and you just do your thing, and you know what I mean? It's like, most of those guys, like I said, I was from Chicago. I grew up on the playing on the South Side all the time. And those guys, they didn't care. You know what I mean? They didn't care. It wasn't them that ever cared in that. But I think, if you look back, if you really take a look back at the blues, especially let's say over the last 10, 15 years, maybe 20 years or whatever, the people to me that have always stood out outside of, of course, the Stevie Ray Vaughans and those people is the Michael Burks.
Yo,
Michael, Larry McCrae. I mean, you
man,
want to
Mike,
talk
yes.
about great guitar tone, which
Right.
was driven. It wasn't
Oh, yeah.
into a Fender amp with
No.
no reverb.
No.
It was a driven sound,
I'm so
and
glad you mentioned Michael Burks, because Michael is, and I mean this 100%, man. He is my all-time favorite blues man, period. And I cover, and people that know my career, I cover him all the time. I mean, I've done, on my last like five records, I've done a Michael Burks song on every record, because I love the guy, man. And I became, I mean, I won't say close, but I became friends with him enough to where if I showed up to see him, he would come over. Hey, he knew who I was, and he knew that I was covering him, and he loved it. And what people don't know about Michael, and I love this kind of conversation, man. So you can tell me to shut up if we go over time. I love this. I love this. Because what the purists don't understand is Michael and I, so a black guy from Little Rock, Arkansas, who's twice my age, him and I would sit down and talk about the nerdiest, about what tubes were in his Dumble, which version of the Klon. I mean, me and him, when we sat down and talked about gear, we were the same. We were like one, And it bugs me that the purists, like, it's like almost like they speak for him. I'm like, you guys, if you knew what Michael thought of me, you would shut up, man, because Michael and I are like this, man. Michael and I respect each other as players and as artists and as musicians, and we talk about tone and gear. And Michael, it's funny that Michael was on Alligator Records, and I'll tell you why that's funny to me, because I know Bruce Iglauer, and I know what he looks for in an artist, and it cracks me up. And I mean this in a good way. I'm just being silly. It cracks me up that Michael got away with what he did on Alligator Records, because Michael, if you listen to the album, I think it was the I Smell Smoke album, or
yeah.
And man, his tone is every bit as high gain as mine.
Yep.
And if, to be honest, if not even a little more, actually. I mean, every time that album comes on in the car when I'm driving around, I go, man, his tone on this is massive. It's like insane. And I'm laughing. I'm going, I love that he did that on a Bruce Iglauer record. I love that, man. Like that, I get such a kick out of that because Bruce is such a traditionalist.
Right.
And I love that, you know, Michael did an album with a high gain rock tone. And I every time that comes on in the car, I smile. I just go, this is great, man. This is great. So I think, you know, getting back to the original question, I have never had a problem with another musician.
Yeah.
The only haters that I have are non-musicians who are not in the business. Because musicians, the way musicians think, and as you know, is if we look at each other and we go, all right, the guys, he's out there, he's hustling, he's working his ass off, and he's not harming anyone. Mm-hmm. That is what gets you respect in the business. That's it. If you're doing your thing, you're being true to yourself, and you're working hard, you'll get respect from everybody in the business. So I have never, in my 25 years, I have never had any kind of altercations, disputes. Every musician I've encountered is super cool. Black, white, doesn't matter. It's the people that are not musicians that are critical and nasty. You know, it's like, it's so strange, man. It's so strange. So
yeah, well, I think there's a common bond, I think, amongst musicians in that, you know, it's like, especially, you know, when you get to a certain level, because people understand what it takes to get there and to stay there and to function there.
Right.
So it's completely different than, you know, when you're first starting out and you're playing local bars and things of that nature. And I know for myself, you know, like you, I know musicians all over the world. I know some of the greatest guitar players in the world. And everybody is always so genuine.
Yes.
I've done over 500 interviews.
Wow.
And out of those 500 interviews, there's only been two people I didn't air their interviews because they were assholes.
Wow.
Everybody else has been extremely generous.
Yes,
and kind and gracious. Yes. You know, it's amazing to me.
Yes.
You know,
I agree.
It doesn't matter. The bigger they are sometimes, the more, you know, approachable and down to earth. You know, it's amazing. And but you know what? People need to I think that people need to be more appreciative of the talent and the sacrifice. You know, and if you don't dig it, if it's not your thing, well, fucking move on.
Thank you. Yes, that's what I say all the time, because, you know, like whenever, and I'll be honest, man, I'm lucky. I don't get that much hate. Like it really is like 95% love out there, even on the internet, which it was funny. The guy, Peter Wolf, the guy who is the business manager for Nags, him and I are real good friends. We talk on the phone all the time. And Peter always says to me, he goes, Eric, it's really crazy. He goes, I check the comments that people write to you on Instagram, Facebook. He goes, Eric, you're one of the few artists that it's like 90% positive. He's like, there's very few negative comments. And he's right. So I'm very lucky in that. But what I will say is about the negative comments, I always laugh because I'm like, if I'm putting a gun to someone's head and saying, you have to listen to my music, okay, then I'll give them that. But if you don't, if you're someone who says, yeah, that whole Eric Steckel thing with the distortion and that's not my thing. No problem. Then don't watch the video.
Right.
If there's a TV show that I don't like, I'm not going to purposely sit there and subject myself to it. Right. Like,
and complain about it.
Right. So that's the one thing about the music business that always sort of confounds me. I'm like, people that write in like, yeah, this is blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, you're the one who took the 5 minutes out of your day to watch it. So, you know, I'm not, none of us are forcing you, man. If you don't like what I'm doing, just move on.
Right. You know, right? you're doing you know, you're doing good though, man. It's like you're constantly on tour.
Yeah.
You know, every time I turn around, you know, you're out there and you're playing. The stuff that you present to the public, whether it's video or whether it's your albums and that, it's all quality, top notch. I mean, it's not, you know what I mean? And from a guitar player standpoint, of course, your sound is definitely a sound that I dig. But then again, I love Jeff Goldblum. And I also love David Gilmour.
Right.
And, you know, Chris Stranling. I mean, there's all kinds of great players out there.
Yeah.
And you just learn to appreciate the talent behind it.
Absolutely. Look,
I met Brian Wilson and Paul Stanley. Had brunch with both of them one time. Now, I'm going to admit on this film in front of the million or so people that are going to tune in, I'm not a fan of Kiss.
Right.
And I'm not a fan of the Beach Boys.
Right.
But I have immense respect for what they've accomplished and the talent behind them.
Absolutely.
And I would be a complete idiot or a complete fool to just, you know,
discount
them simply because I didn't like their, you know, what they did.
Exactly. You know? I'm so in agreement with that, man. I'm so in agreement because, because like you said, I tour all the time. So we see, you know, because we're always playing festivals, clubs, we see like thousands of bands, you know, we cross paths with so many people. And I always say this to, you know, my guys, you know, my driver, merch guy, whatever. I always say this to my crew. I say, man, you know, I don't have to like someone's music. But if they're working their ass off, then they're great.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as long as that person gets up every day with good intentions and says, I am going to be the best version of myself I can be. I'm going to work my ass off. I'm going to put, you know, my heart and soul into this business. Then you got my respect.
Yeah.
You know, even if you're like you know, playing Jimmy Buffett kind of music, you know, even if it's something that's like way different than I like, if you're good at it, And you hustle, you're great.
Yeah,
you're great. Yeah. You know, and you're right, man. I think music fans, you know, they maybe squabble a little too much, you know, in the comment section about opinions, and because it's like you said, man, if you don't like a certain thing, don't listen to it. You know,
right.
And I want to mention one thing as well. Something that another opinion about this topic. When we talk about the blues genre, I always used country music as an example, because country music, you know, about 20 years ago went through that major like restructuring, rebranding thing, where it went from sort of this Dwight Yoakam Cracker Barrel kind of image, right, to the whole Girls and Daisy Dukes in the pickup truck, and these guys are playing like soccer arenas, you know, and the country music business became like, you know, massive money, right?
Yeah.
And I always talk about the blues, and I say, I really wish that the blues industry maybe took a page from that, you know, because I think that this genre is great, and I think it deserves to be more financially viable.
Yeah. It is such a, you know, unfortunately, it's such a small percentage of the industry. You know, I think blues, if I'm correct, is, you know, takes up like 1% of the market in that. But it's got a loyal fan base, you know, all over the world, as you know, especially when you get across, you know, to Europe and Asia and some of those areas. I mean, they're huge, massive fans of that style of music in that.
Oh, yeah.
But before, because I've probably kept you way too long. But
it's okay. I'm good. I enjoy it, man. I enjoy it. It's good.
I gotta know about the guitar.
Sure.
I gotta know about the Nag guitars. I mean, they look like works of art. You know.
Yeah, it's man. Another one of these moments where you just go, "Wow, the universe was looking out for me on this one, man." Because like, I think around 2017, I had been playing Tom Anderson guitars for many years, and those are great guitars. Tom is you know, fantastic. But they're still Strat based.
Yeah.
And that's great. But I was at a point in my career where I was really wanting to go in a direction where my sound was more massive, more mm-hmm. junk, more of that, you know, that yeah. just that thick, you know, thing that like rattles the pant legs, right?
Right.
So I actually bought, so now, you know, Joe Nags and Peter Wolf are dear friends of mine now. But I had never really heard of these guys, and so in 2017, I went on Reverb.com, and there was this beautiful Nags Severn, which the Severn model is their super Strat, mm-hmm. you know, single right. hum, tremolo, you know, right. and I just bought it because I didn't. Some people would say, yeah, but you should have just called them, asked for an endorsement, whatever. But you know, I'm not really a beggar. I don't really do that thing where I like hit everybody up for a freebie or whatever, you know,
right,
I just
right.
never really do that. So I bought the guitar, and then the story is I get the guitar in the mail. I do an unboxing sort of video. I'm playing it like on a Facebook Live thing. I'm playing it. And one of the guys watching the Facebook Live was friends with Peter Wolf from Nags. So he sends Peter the link and goes, hey, do you know this guy? He's doing a live session right now with one of your guitars. So the next day I get a phone call from Peter Wolf, and Peter says, hey, you know, really great to meet you. He says, I'll cut to the chase. I talked to Joe about you last night. We'd love to bring you into the team, and not just an endorsement, but actually build a guitar to your specs and sell it. And I said, oh yeah, like a signature guitar. He said, well, yeah. But he said, there's two ways we could do this. We could do it the ego way. This is a direct quote from Peter. I love the guy. He goes, we could do it the ego way where we have, you know, the whole guitar is like a shrine to you with your last name and everything. Or he said, we could play it low key and make a guitar that you design with us, but we don't make it an ego machine. We don't put your logos and graphics and things and put your name on the 12th fret like everybody does, you know. And he says, if we go that way, he goes, I guarantee you, you're going to sell more, and you're going to sell more to pro players who don't want to be seen playing someone else's guitar.
Right.
And man, was he right. Because yeah. my signature guitar with Nags is right now is on a stadium tour with Morgan Wallen, the number one country artist. The guy who plays for him has two of my Steckel models. And so every night, you know, 20,000 people are seeing my guitar. And that would have never happened if I said, yeah, I want Steckel here, Steckel here, Steckel right. here. Because all these pro players would say, no way, man, I'm not, you know, advertising for this guy, right?
Yeah.
So that's how it came about. And all we did was they had a guitar already called a Kanai. And it's this exact shape. It's mm-hmm. kind of a Telecaster meets a Les Paul shape.
Right.
Which is really comfortable for all the curves or everything's in the right spot, you know?
Right.
But here was the problem. The regular Kanai was maybe like half this thickness, and it had, you see, this has just a tiny, tiny back carve, hardly any carve.
Right.
The regular Kanai has a full belly cutout. Mm. So there's just not a lot of wood. It's a thin guitar. And I said to Peter, I said, well, listen, the first thing that I would do to make an Eric Steckel model would be I want it thick with no belly cutout. And Peter laughed. He goes, yeah, because you're young, you don't have a beer belly yet. I said, yeah, right, exactly. And he said, no problem. He says, no problem, we can do that. So this guitar that I'm holding right now, if you see, there's a blank truss rod.
Right.
This was the prototype that Joe Nags built and sent me and said, Eric, it's just a first attempt. Don't expect it to be perfect. Whatever you want changed, send it back. We'll pay for the shipping. We'll fix it and send it back. Well, it's still here, man. It's still here.
He ain't getting that one back.
Yep, exactly. And this one, I mean, it has probably the coolest top I've ever seen, man.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. Yeah.
So basically, yeah. So the short story is, they sent me this. I remember like 5 days after this arrived in the mail, I had a European tour, so I took it, and it got a lot of stage time. I got a lot of bonding with it. And when I came back from the tour, Peter said to me, he said, "Eric, tell Joe what you like and don't like." And I said, "I have no dislikes." I
Yeah.
said, "Let's do it." And
Yeah.
then I think the first Steckle shipped in September 2018. And without giving away too much private information, I can tell you that our sales numbers on this guitar are way past what we had ever envisioned.
Yeah.
So it's really been an unbelievable collaboration, man. Really amazing.
Yeah. Well, I've come close a couple of times to actually buying it myself.
Oh,
Yeah, I have. I said that to Jared James Nichols too about his signature model.
Oh,
I said,
yeah.
you never, but I said, I've come really close. And the good thing is, and maybe I'll do this with you too, I don't know. I waited a little while until Jared finally just said, ah, Jimmy, just take one.
Well, I was gonna say,
I'm
no, I
just
was gonna
kidding.
say, like, before you said that, I was gonna say that, hey,
Yeah.
listen, I mean, I have part of my contract with Nags, there's even a clause in there. It's something like friends and family, like anyone
Right.
that I refer gets like an instant off the top 40% discount.
Wow. Wow.
So obviously that would include you and anybody that I want to bring in. And I've done this. I don't know if you've seen videos or well, for your listeners, any videos you see of me on stage where the bass player has a green bass with a racing stripe, that's a
Yeah.
Nags bass. And that was because I brought, this my bass player Jos, the European guy.
Yeah.
I brought him into the world, and Peter said, "Yep, instant artist discount, and
Yeah.
we'll build him a bass." And they built him that British Racing Green 5-string Severn bass with the
Yeah.
active humbucker, and man, whew,
Yeah.
that thing is mean.
Yeah.
Wow.
So what kind of pickups are in yours?
After my deal with Seymour Duncan was struck in 2019, where I developed a pickup with them, with MJ, from that point on, all of my guitars, even the ones that were built prior, we took them all to the Nags shop, and Lucas put all of the new Candy pickups in all my guitars because I wanted consistency. I didn't want to
Yeah.
have one guitar with a hot pickup and then one with, because if I break a string, which happens, I want to be able to grab a guitar on stage and have the same tone.
Right.
So all of my guitars now have these Candy pickups, which is a pickup I developed with Seymour and MJ back in 2019. And what it is it's a low output, only 7.5K, so very low output, Alnico 3 humbucker, which MJ told me. I mean, MJ is like the world renowned expert on pickups. She is like everybody knows, like if you have a pickup, she knows everything.
Yeah.
And she told me, she said, "Yeah, we only have," she said, "your pickup, and I think there's one other pickup in the whole Duncan lineup that's a three." So it's my pickup and one other one are Alnico 3s, and everything else is 2 and 5.
Right.
So it's kind of cool to have something unique with a big
Yeah.
company like Duncan to have some, because I was afraid that I was going to make a pickup with them that would be like just the same old thing, another Alnico 5 humbucker. Because it's like, come on, the world doesn't need any more of those, right?
Right.
So it was really cool that we were able to use, an Alnico 3 magnet, which is something that's very rare.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's great, and it's very, the reason why my pickups sound the way they do is because we designed it for high gain.
Yeah.
And when some people hear this, like the older cats who were playing back in the day of like the Jose Marshalls and those kind of, when those guys hear that I designed a pickup for high gain, they're expecting it to be hot
Yeah.
because they come from the world of amps had no gain, right?
Right.
But now amps like my Meza Barba, man,
Yeah.
that's more than enough gain for, you'll never need more. So it's actually better to have a low output pickup into a high gain amp because you get the clarity and the brightness.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can tell you the combination of the amp and the guitar. I mean, again, go back to the beginning of the conversation. The sound is it's just crazy, man. So what are you doing? I know you're doing shows and stuff right now. Yeah. Are you in the studio? Because I don't know this. Are you in the studio now recording? You got an album coming out or you got another steakhouse session or?
Glad you mentioned that. Thank you. Yeah. So yeah. We just wrapped the Steakhouse Sessions Volume 2. And this is, I'm really proud of this one because for folks who you know, follow my career and know everything I do, the Steakhouse Volume 1, I'm proud of it, but it was old material. I mean, it was original stuff, but it was stuff that I had already recorded. Mm-hmm. Because the people don't know this, but the whole reason we did Steakhouse Volume 1, it was actually something that we weren't even going to sell originally. It was something that we were going to do just for, because my manager was asking for a new EPK. And so I came up with the idea of going to Lukather's, you know, studio and having my friend Greg V from Bogner come in and film it. So it was supposed to be just like an internal industry product. But then it came out so awesome that we were like, oh, come on, we got to sell this, man. We got to put it out. Yeah. And I'm glad we did. But Steakhouse Volume 2, which we just finished last week, it's all brand new material. So we approached it a little differently. Like, it wasn't like, okay, go into Steakhouse and just play, just jam on old material. No, this was stuff that nobody's heard yet. These were songs that I've been keeping private. So this I'm way more proud of. This Steakhouse Volume 2 is way more, it's just on a higher level. It's, we put more time into it. We put more effort into it. The songwriting is better. The performances are better. The singing is way better, actually, because I've been working privately. I don't tell people all this stuff, but I've been working privately on my vocals the last couple of years and learning some tricks and things. So the vocals are really strong on this upcoming EP. And two out of three of the songs, I was tuned to drop B, but on a sixth string, on my nags. Wow. So it's really cool because we have a song called Evil Blues on this EP, and it's a slow blues, but it's in drop B with the heavy tone. So this, I'm really excited for this song to come out, specifically this song, because I think it's actually purist proof, because it is a blues. It is a 6/8, bah, 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 bah. It is a low down gut bucket blues song, right? And I wrote it about an evil chick that I used to date. So it's real blues, man. But it's in drop B with a mezza barba on 10. Wow. So it's this perfect combination of all the things I love, which is real low down blues, but with a high gain, like kick your ass kind of tone. So yeah. I really think that that's going to be the song that my fans are really going to relate to. I think that's the one that people are going to say, yeah, man, that's it, you know.
Well, you stand out, you know, amongst a lot of people when it comes to what you do. You know, there's very few, in my opinion, you know, in the world of blues rock, if you don't mind me putting it in
there. Yeah, yeah.
There's very few in that world that, you know, have the, that command the presence with the tone, you know, that you do and stuff. And, you know, I'm really glad that we finally got an opportunity to talk and to meet. And,
yes,
you know, I don't say this to everybody, but I hope that we can stay in touch over time. Because, man, I'd love to come see you play. Of course, I'm going to bug you to sit in.
No problem. remind me, where are you located again?
My studio here is south of Chicago. I'm about an hour south of Chicago.
Okay,
I've got another studio in Nashville, actually.
Oh, that's what I saw on the email. Yeah, right. Okay, right. Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah, I mean, it's great, man. It's really cool to have finally done this with you. And I love this stuff because, you know, for me, like, I think there's so many there's so many like things I just don't normally get a platform to address. And I love when someone like you, you know, allows me that, gives me that, because mm-hmm. I do think that, not to get too into the weeds in this, but I do think that there is a portion of the population that, does not get me, mm-hmm. or they have a wrong perception of me, or they just misunderstand me. And I love when I'm able to come on a play, you know, a show like yours and just kind of like address some of these things, because, you know, I think people, the way I promote myself on social media, for folks who know my personality, they get it. They're like, oh man, Eric's a hard worker. He's a hard worker. He's always working it, pushing it. But there are some people that take it the wrong way.
Right.
And I've seen this. And so I just love when I'm able to come on shows and explain to people where I'm coming from and why I do certain things that I do. And you know, like, because one thing that we stopped doing, I don't know if you noticed this when you were, you know, getting all those things together to interview me, but a couple of years ago, I just stopped using the word blues in all of my promotional literature. And that was a deliberate reason, because I respect the genre, and I don't want to I don't want anyone to show up expecting a traditional blues gig and be like horrible, you know, and have a you know, a stack of mezzabarbas on 10 in their face, go like, whoa, what is it? So yeah. I feel that I love when I'm able to come on a podcast or a show and just kind of explain my side of things and tell people why I've made some of the decisions that I've made, because whenever I do this, I always get messages from people and go, man, I never knew this, or I wish I knew, you know? Right. So I just want to say thank you for giving artists like myself the platform to do it, you know?
Yeah, well, you're more than welcome, you know? And just so you know, I don't do extensive background search on people. I know you because right. I listen to you and I follow you. I have a good, you know, I know your gear because I, right. you know, I pay attention. But what I try to do is just have, you know, hopefully this has just been a conversation and not an interview, you know, and
right.
and that. But I really appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you, you know, giving me the time. You've been so gracious with your time.
Sure.
I wish
you
all the success with the new album and the tour and all that. And, you know,
thank
if you get when you get near and around Chicago, I am going to.
Excellent.
Go up.
Yeah, a lot of folks, this is the thing I see a lot on Facebook. People are like, come on, Eric, you're always in Europe. You know, when's the U.S. tour? And I finally have good news about that. We're going to be I think it starts already in February. We're going to be doing a full U.S. run. We're going to be, we have a lot of Southeast already booked, you know, Richmond, Charlotte, Raleigh. Right. Savannah, Jacksonville, we already have a lot of those. And then I think we're going to just, you know, just kind of make our way west until we're back home, you know, in LA. So that's, so for your listeners, it's coming. I hear you, I hear you guys loud and clear. I know, man, I know we've been prioritizing Europe a little too much this year and I'm aware of it. So, and in fact, I'm actually, tonight I'm actually off to LAX to, fly to, Rome tomorrow morning. So I'm always on the go, man. And I'm always, always traveling. And every year that I do this, I learn more about how to travel with guitars, man. That's the big thing.
That's an art too within
that's
itself.
That's an art.
You know, in March of every year, I host a guitar show. It's called the Illinois Guitar and Gear Expo. I have people like yourself. Last year, Jared James Nichols was here and Chuck Wendler from Blacktop Mojo. This year, Andy Timmons is going to be there. And so if it's cool, I'm going to reach out to your manager and see if you're going to be in the region or the area during that show. We'd love to have you come, you know.
Right. The timing sounds perfect because from what I gather, from what he's told me already, it's like if we're going to be doing East Coast February, makes sense that, you know, by March or whatever, we should be probably in the Midwest. So that might work out just right. That might be perfect.
Yeah. So I'll reach out, you know, and we'll see in that. But I wish you all the best. I really do. Keep doing what you do, man. I love the sound. I love the playing. personally myself, and
cool.
You know, cool. Stay in touch.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Thanks for being accommodating with rescheduling and everything. And yeah, it's great, man. I'm going to please, you know, give me all the links and things. I'll share with the fan base, and yeah, let's maybe do it again sometime. You know.
Yeah, sounds great. You take care of yourself and travel safe. Okay, Eric.
Got it, man. Cheers.
All right, man. Later.
Cheers.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that conversation with Eric Steckel. I hope you learned a thing or two about how he creates his sound and the gear that he uses, because, man, I want one of those amps really bad. I'm hoping Santa will be good to me. I want to thank Eric for participating in this episode. Do yourself a favor. Make sure you're following him, sharing what he does, liking what he does, purchasing his music, supporting him in any way you possibly can, and get out and see him live. You will not regret it. So, you know, I want to thank Eric. Now, next week, are you sitting down still? Next week, Glenn Hughes and his guitarist, Soren Anderson, will be right here on Guitar Talk. So until then, do yourself a favor. Follow me on social media, on Facebook and TikTok. And, mark your calendars for next week with Glenn Hughes and Soren Anderson right here on Guitar Talk.